Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's dialogue for State Ombudsman on the new Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services Rules. This is Aaliyah Murphy, Associate Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program and Policy with the National Ombudsman Resource Center. I'm going to review a few housekeeping tips, and then we can get started. During the presentations, all lines are going to be muted. Then we will open up the line so that you can ask questions of our presenters and dialogue with one another. During this time, if you are not speaking and wish to mute your line, you can do so by using the mute button on your phone or by pressing *6. Also, as you may have heard a moment ago, this webinar is being recorded. The webinar recording and PowerPoint slides will be posted on the login side of the NORC website in the near future. So the purpose of today's dialogue is to give you an overview of the new Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services Rules, which went into effect on March 17th of this year, and which for the first time set federal standards to ensure Medicaid HCBS is provided in the most integrated community setting and require person-centered care. As these rules go into effect, it will be important for long-term care ombudsmen to look at opportunities for involvement in their implementation. Our first speaker today is Eric Carlson. Eric is the directing attorney for the National Senior Citizens Law Center, and he will be giving you an overview of the new rules as well as the state transition plans. Eric, you can go ahead and press *7 to begin speaking.
Terrific. Thanks. Thanks very much. I appreciate being able to be here today. You can move the slide forward. And move it forward again. So the purpose of these rules is to make sure that home and community-based services really are provided in settings that are community-based. HCBS exists in order to give people an alternative to nursing facilities, and the critique in past years by some folks has been that HCBS has been used wrongly to put people in settings that really were institutional, that segregated people. I think assisted living facilities were subject to criticism, and group homes and other. You're all familiar with this, and so the political pressure increased, and CMS decided to establish some standards, and the standards are in the middle. For example, if you're thinking of assisted living, that you'll see that they're still allowed to receive reimbursement under HCBS rules, even though they're facilities. But the standards are going to be imposed to make sure that those services are provided, that the settings are sufficiently community-based and are not overly institutional. The rules became effective in mid-March of this year, but you'll see just because they're effective doesn't mean that states are following them. At this point, there's a transition process, and over the next 10 months or so, the states will have to come up with transition plans, and then for a year or two after that, in some cases, the states will be implementing the new rules in their own programs. And by their terms, the rules apply to home and community-based service waivers. Those are the 1915C programs. State plan HCBS, which is similar, but it's provided through a state plan rather than a waiver and cannot be limited in the ways that waivers are limited. And also the community first option, the first choice option programs, which are called Section 1915K. Next slide, please. It covers residential and non-residential settings, but exactly how it's going to be applied to non-residential settings, like daycare centers, for example, is very much up in the air. CMS has promised some guidance, and it hasn't come out yet, and states, by and large, are still waiting for that guidance in order to decide how to address non-residential settings. Next slide, please. We'll talk first about the standards for all HCBS settings and then move into the residential settings. Next slide, please. these are fairly broad standards. You'll see that wonderful terms. The question is, as always, how they get operationalized. The setting has to be integrated with the community. People have to have choice. They have various rights and independence as well. Next slide, please. And so, I mean, this is one area where the states are going to have some discretion, and it's one area where stakeholders will want to get involved and say specifically to the states, look, this is what, in real life, this is what independence means. This is what dignity means. This is what choice means. These are the sort of things that you have to be conscious of. CMS has given some guidance. These exploratory questions is a 5 or 6 page document that came out a month or two ago, and here's just some examples of some questions that CMS isn't mandating, but it's made the optional questions that the state has, that CMS has made available to states, that suggesting that they may want to use these questions in evaluating their programs. And it gives, you can see through these questions some hint of which way the wind is blowing within CMS. And things that stakeholders should think about, things like looking at this slide, public transportation, or whether schedules are posted publicly. That's a bad thing, for example. That's more of an institutional thing, as I'm sure folks would know, as opposed to a community-based thing. And again, thinking more about institutional practices, how does staff talk about people? Do they talk about them like they're not even there? Or one of the questions asks, does the staff just use common terms, sweetie, honey, as opposed to addressing people by their names? And all these are things that folks should be conscious of in figuring out how to put content into these great ideas of dignity and choice, et cetera. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Talk about the residential care facilities. These are the provider-controlled settings, which are residential care facilities, which for older folks are probably assisted living or something comparable. There are also, obviously, residential settings for younger folks as well. And because the risk is greater in these settings that they will be institutional, there are specific requirements in the federal regulations which apply only to these facilities. And the five areas are listed here on this slide. We're going to walk through them here in the next couple of minutes. Next slide, please. The protection against eviction. The idea here is that people should have a home, and if they are to have a home, it doesn't mean that they have just some place in a facility, room 104, 209, or 304B, they have a specific identifiable place, and they have to have that within this provider control setting, and there have to be protections against eviction that are at least as strong as the state landlord-tenant law. And there should be, if the landlord-tenant law doesn't explicitly apply to these facilities due to how the state law is set up, the facilities are required to establish written documents that would apply equivalent protection to individuals in the facility. Next slide, please. So it's a workaround around state law. So it's a written document which gives people equivalent protections to what they get under state law. As to privacy, in general, folks should have lockable doors to their units. Keys can be held by appropriate staff, and we'll talk in a couple minutes from now. There are exceptions to these things under certain circumstances. You can imagine the objections here. Does it make sense to have lockable doors for some folks, particularly folks with dementia? And we'll see that, and just we'll talk about those exceptions in just a couple minutes. Also, relating to privacy and choice, people have the choice of should have a choice of roommates. Roommates shouldn't be imposed upon them. And I'll take a moment here just to talk about the concept of roommates in the first place, that this has been one of the criticisms of a lot of assisted living waivers, for example, that they've called for shared occupancy, and the critique is, well, it's difficult to talk about something as really community-based if you're forced to share a room with somebody. Should be clear that the federal regulations, at least, didn't really fix that problem. And the underlying problem is financial. So people have the right to choose under the federal regulations, but the regulations also say that choice can be constrained by finances. And due to the way that state Medicaid programs are generally set up, in a lot of cases, Medicaid beneficiaries are not going to have enough available income to afford private occupancy, at least under the federal regs. But here's another area where states are perfectly free to go beyond that, and it's something that people should be conscious of. Just understand the issue is there, and if you want to require private occupancy in your particular state, the state's going to have to go beyond what CMS is mandated in the regulations. Next slide, please. More with freedom of choice, ability to decorate, control the schedules, access to food at any time, which cannot be just some water and crackers or cookies. It's got to be something more substantial than that. CMS didn't go into any too much detail beyond that. Next slide, please. And right to accept visitors any time, with the proviso, however, that the right to visitors doesn't extend to having people move in 24/7 for weeks at a time. So the right to visit does not turn into the right to move in. Next slide, please. Talking about modification, the easiest example is the key dementia issue, but there may be some other issues as well, and the regulations allow those requirements that we just talked about to be modified if the modification is set out in the individual's service plan, I'll say that I know our organization, and I think many others, objected to that kind of provision when comments were out there saying that it's just too easy to evade regulations if all that's required to eliminate the protection is that something be included in the service plan. But be that as it may, that's the kind of exception that's now memorialized in the regulations. But I think, to the credit of CMS at least, there are some significant limitations on this ability to change the standards through service plans. There have to be alternative strategies that are tried first. The need has to be addressed in the service plan. And what may be the most powerful protection is that the service plan can only be changed if there's informed consent by the consumer. So if they don't want to lose the protection of a particular regulatory provision, that should be within the individual's control. If you don't want to change, you don't consent. Easier said than done. I know I've been involved with enough service plans to understand that what seems clear from a lawyer's desk or from anybody's desk is not so clear in the real world. But that's people should understand that this is subject to informed consent, and people should take that seriously. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Some settings are just flat out prohibited from getting HCBS reimbursement, and this, of course, applies to institutions, and some institutions are explicitly identified: nursing facilities, hospitals, IMDs, ICFs. No surprises there. Next slide, please. But the disqualification is also extended to locations that have the qualities of institutional settings. So they're not licensed or certified as institutions, but they're close enough to institutions that HCBS reimbursement isn't going to be allowed for them. And so there's a presumption here that these settings have institutional qualities if the setting is sharing a building with a facility providing inpatient care, if it's on the grounds of or adjacent to a public institution, and a public institution is something like a state psychiatric hospital. It doesn't include a nursing facility or some other things. Or, and here's a really broad category, any other setting that has the effect of isolating individuals. And a presumption is not the same as a flat-out disqualification. It just means that the initial burden is against that particular setting, that the CMS is going to look at it with a jaundiced eye, and it's going to be up to the state, if the state nonetheless wants to include settings like that, to make the case as to why those settings should be included. Next slide, please. And this says exactly that the state has to make the case, and then it's CMS makes the decision as to what the CMS is going to allow or disallow. Next slide, please. CMS has noted this was an issue that was of particular interest in the aging services world, whether CCRCs, continuing care retirement communities, would be included, and they are. You can see on the face of it, they're very segregative, that folks are, you know, in these communities, that's really the ideal, the idea to a certain extent, that you're separate from the broader community, but you're sharing space with a nursing facility. You're on the grounds of a nursing facility, but CMS in a discussion of settings that are perhaps prone to isolating people, identified CCRCs as settings that likely would not be disqualified because they usually include a level of care for people who are living independently. Next slide, please. We mentioned non-residential settings. That's still up in the air because CMS is going to release guidance. I'll just make the note here that actually a non-residential provider may be disqualified if the consumer's residence is out of compliance, even if this HCBS is not provided at the residence. So it's really broad. If there's a whole system that is keeping people, that's allowing people to stay in what's considered an institutional environment, those services are not going to be eligible for HCBS reimbursement. Next slide, please. Talk a little bit about transition here. Next slide. This little schematic, we can summarize it like this, that the state has to deal with this by March of next year. The state's going to have to come up with a transition plan that explains how all of its HCBS is going to be provided pursuant to the new regulations. However, you know, if within that year the state's going to have to deal with this anyway because of an amendment of a particular program or renewal of a particular program, CMS is going to demand that the state deal with it at that earlier time. So the regulations are have to be included in whatever the state submits for the renewal or for the amendment, and then within 4 months after that, the state's going to have to submit a transition plan that describes how the entire state's HCBS is going to be brought into compliance. Next slide, please. And then the stakeholders have to have an opportunity to participate, and all of us are certainly, you know, I encourage everybody in this call to really dig into the details as much as possible. There has to be a 30-day notice and comment period for stakeholders to comment on a draft transition plan, and then CMS has also said that it'll accept comments from state stakeholders even after the document has been finalized from the state's point of view and submitted to CMS. Next slide, please. And so people need to think about it as quickly as possible. Some states are already in it. You can see if a state has a renewal or an amendment coming up soon. This is happening right now. And even if a state doesn't have to deal with this until January, February, March of next year, there's limited time. We're already mid-2014, amazingly. So people should think about assessment, looking around at existing settings, figuring out whether they're in or out or whether they should be in and out, and then also thinking about what changes need to be made and how the standards that the state follows and how those standards are enforced. And fortunately, we got a lot of time here to discuss it. I'll just mention a couple things that are still on this PowerPoint, and then we'll pass the microphone over to Robin. So next slide, please. And next slide, please. We'll just mention these quickly, so recognizing we may have more discussions about them later. One issue is the private pay issue, and there is some ambiguity here, I think, in the regs. So we are encouraging people to advocate for a system that would apply in residential care facilities these regulations to everybody regardless of reimbursement source. The legal argument of support of that is listed here, that the regulations refer broadly to individual or individuals in most cases, and there's a couple of instances where it's specified that the regs are only talking about HCBS participant, but showing that level of specificity in those particular instances indicates that when it just talks to individual or individuals, that should be read broadly. Next slide, please. But the bigger point is, and everybody on this call, I think, can get this, that the payment source discrimination is really bad. All of us have experience of this in nursing facilities, and we don't want to see that in residential care facilities where facilities treat people differently depending on what their reimbursement source is, or dole out rights that vary depending on what people's reimbursement is, or segregate people within the different places in the facility to keep all this separate based on reimbursement source. Very institutional and bad practice. So we're encouraging CMS and the states to make it clear that the protections apply to all residents regardless of reimbursement source. Next slide, please. And also, I think people should really focus on enforcement mechanisms. We've got these really positive standards now and I'm thinking now specifically about residential care facilities, but the same discussion applies also to other settings other kinds of services, but particularly a residential care facility. You've got these standards dealing with privacy and eviction and choice and visitation, and the question is, how are you going to make sure that the people actually follow this? And there's a lot of work, I think, that states are going to have to do to incorporate these in the licensure rules, for example. That's one possibility, or come up with some mechanism to enforce it through their health departments. Right now, their states don't have any, I would say in general, don't have any capacity to do this, and the people in the Medicaid programs have really been completely hands-off as far as to what the residential care facilities are doing. But I think that has to change. And again, as advocates for individual residents, we can certainly understand that. People have a problem. They're deprived of visitation rights, or they're threatened with eviction. Where are the standards? Who do you complain to? How do you make things happen? And there's definitely some work there that needs to be done. So with that, I'll pass the discussion over to Robin. We can pick up with some of these questions later.
Okay, great. Thanks, Eric. So next we're going to hear from Robin Grant, who is the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with the Consumer Voice. Robin, if you want to hit *7 and you can begin to speak. Robin, can you hit *7 to unmute your line? Robin, we still can't hear you. So have you hit the, if you hit the mute button on your phone, you're going to need to hit that. So since we're having trouble reaching Robin, Becky, if you wanted to go ahead and share the federal perspective on the new rules, you can hit star 7.
I just did that. Can you hear me?
I can.
Hooray! Hello, everyone. Good to be with you, at least virtually. I had just a few points that I wanted to add to Eric's comments and hopefully to Robin's comments later. One is that I think Eric said this, but I just want to emphasize how unprecedented this new CMS rule is. It really is the first time that there have been federal standards that apply to assisted living and board and care homes that participate in the Medicaid program through the waivers. It certainly is broader than those settings, but for ombudsman work focused on facility settings, this provides that first time ever historical expectation from the federal government. And so it's a huge opportunity as a result. The fact that it focuses on person-centered planning and very individualized services is very much in line with the way that ombudsmen work with residents, and so I think there'll be a lot of things in those standards that you'll find resonate with your approach in working with residents. And the other piece of this that it provides an opportunity for is it provides a structure for states to review what their current requirements are, their licensing requirements or whatever standards they have for assisted living and board and care. And again, this is broader than those settings, but for ombudsman work especially, the fact that states are going to have to review what they've got in place and whether those things meet these standards or not, I think is going to be a really difficult but very healthy exercise for states to go through. So the first thing is I think it's unprecedented. The second thing is you as ombudsman have such a critical piece to play here on really three different levels. One is on that individual level of are these standards getting applied to the individual? You may remember that quote from Arthur Fleming from the very beginning of the ombudsman program about nursing homes and saying nursing home regulations have been passed, but unless they're applied to the individual, what difference does it make? I'm paraphrasing. But in the same way, if these standards are in place, but they don't apply to the individual, what difference does it make? And ombudsmen are so good at connecting those dots for individuals and helping the individuals see the benefit of the impact of those kinds of standards. So that's at the individual level. At the facility level, you all will be in an amazing position to be able to identify whether assisted living and boarding care settings have those HCBS qualities and knowing how to get the information to the right people when you feel like the standards aren't being met at the facility level. And then, of course, at the systems level, now is the time, as Eric has pointed out, to engage with your states on what are they doing in terms of systems design in your state. So my second point there was about your critical role in the rollout of this. And the third point I want to make is that states are really where this is going to matter, at that state level, because the states are completely depending right now on what are CMS giving us as guidance, and then how do we roll these out, and will it really happen in the way it's designed? All that's going to be based on how well states roll this out. First and foremost, CMS is providing guidance to states, and so there are a lot of questions that might come up in our conversations today that CMS has not yet provided guidance to, and states are really hungry for even more guidance. So, you know, as those things come along, we'll be sharing them, and I know Eric and the Resource Center and others will be sharing that too. But for now, we would keep watching what CMS is going to do in terms of guidance on some of these questions that folks have raised. But really, it's the state level where a lot of this is it going to work or is it not? It's going to be very much at the state level to see how the implementation really happens. And then the last thing was, where do you go for more information? So I actually had an opportunity to be on a discussion with CMS about the next steps in implementation yesterday, and I asked what are the things that state ombudsmen should hear about this process and about this rule. And I was told three things from CMS that I want to pass on to you. One is a reminder, and this was in one of Eric's slides, a reminder that the regulation does require a 30-day public comment period on the transition plan before it's submitted to CMS, and that is a really critical opportunity for you all to engage and other advocacy groups in your states to engage. Secondly, they wanted to make sure that you know where to go for interpretive information and for the guidance that they're providing to states, and that's at medicaid.gov/HCBS. That's medicaid.gov/HCBS. And then the last thing was to share with you about if you have specific questions that you feel aren't addressed or concerns that you feel aren't addressed in their materials, they do have a dedicated email for questions, and that's at hcbs@cms.hhs.gov. Again, that's hcbs@cms.hhs.gov for questions directly to CMS about the rule or its implementation. So I will turn it over, hopefully, to Robin, but wanted the chance to just say that, you know, we really appreciate all you are going to do and have been doing in this arena because, like I've said before, and I'll say it one last time, how well states implement this are going to make all the difference in the world in terms of how well the consumers, the individuals living in these settings, and the individuals receiving HCBS will fare under these new standards. And they will benefit largely from the work of stakeholders who really make strong processes and strong systems in the states. So best of luck to you as you go forward with this, and we'll keep you informed as we learn more.
Thanks, Becky. And I think we do have Robin on the line now. Robin?
Hi there. So first of all, I have to apologize that I appear to have disappeared there for a little while. I found myself in a universe of one. All of a sudden, I couldn't hear a thing. So I apologize for that, but I am back. And I just wanted to start by saying that I'm excited about these new regs. I think that they will better ensure that consumers who are receiving HCBS services are receiving them in settings that really are more home-like and not institutional. But as Eric and Becky have both noted, there is a lot that's not clear about how exactly these rules will be operationalized. And I think that creates many opportunities to shape things at both the state and the federal levels, which creates many advocacy opportunities for all of you as state ombudsmen. So I wanted to focus on just a few of those opportunities. There will be many, many opportunities, but I just want to highlight a few. Eric talked a wee little bit about transition plans and discussed that states can request that a presumptively institutional setting can be determined to be HCBS by submitting evidence, and then CMS would make a decision. So one point I'd like to make about the transition plan is to urge all of you to do your own assessment right away of what settings in your state will be presumptively institutional, but that you think should be considered HCBS, and then talk immediately with your state about your thoughts and your recommendations, and advocate for your position. If the state doesn't adopt your position, then you can provide input during the public comment period and mobilize public input as well. As part of these efforts, I think it's really important to try to connect and work with the disability community if you can. If you can agree on what settings are or aren't HCBS, you can then advocate together, which will make you much stronger and much more likely to obtain what you're trying to seek. I think change can be really painful, even when the end result is something we believe is positive. So as I said, I think these regs will really move us toward settings that are more integrated and more home-like. But I think we need to acknowledge the possibility that there may be pain as part of this process. It might be that you have a residential setting in your state that doesn't meet the HCBS characteristics, which means it will no longer be eligible for Medicaid waiver funding. So this could then mean that residents whose care is paid for through those waivers may have to move, which we all know can be a ghastly, horrible situation for those individuals. This could also mean that because that setting is no longer eligible for Medicaid waiver funding, that there are fewer options in your state that are available to consumers, which could impact access. So I would just suggest that you try to get ahead of the curve on this. So for residents who may end up in a residential setting that is not found to be a home and community-based setting, perhaps consider advocating for those individuals to be grandfathered the way we do for nursing homes that withdraw from the Medicaid program. So that might be one possible approach. If you aren't successful in getting folks grandfathered, you might advocate for a very long period of time for residents to be relocated, so maybe a six-month period of time, something like that, with strong provisions that really promote continuity of care, you know, preparation for relocation, all those things that all of you know so well in terms of what's needed to when residents are being relocated. And to address the access issue that could possibly be an unintended consequence, I think you could advocate for the creation of more residential settings that do meet the HCBS characteristics. That probably sounds a little bit simplistic. And it might also entail advocating for increase, ultimately, in provider reimbursement. I don't think increasing options is an easy fix, but it really starts you down the path of developing those additional options. So in addition to looking at the settings, I wanted to highlight a few other areas for systemic advocacy that are perhaps not quite as urgent as the transition plan, but are nonetheless really important. One area relates to the person-centered planning provisions that Eric mentioned. The new regs really have strong and detailed requirements related to person-centered planning. I think certainly stronger than many of us have seen in assisted living facilities. So CMS has said that it'll be issuing guidance on operationalizing person-centered planning. Of course, we don't know when that will come out, but you don't have to wait for that necessarily. You can look at the regs and start thinking already about what implementation of person-centered planning should look like. I think as ombudsman, you all bring a lot of knowledge and experience to this whole arena of person-centeredness. When the CMS guidance does come out, I think you can monitor your state to ensure it's acting on that guidance, and you can advocate for additional guidance that you think might be necessary. And you can also, I think, at any point, start planning how to educate consumers, families, and providers also about person-centered planning. So I think there will be a need for a lot of education. There are also new rights for those who are receiving HCBS services at home and in provider-controlled or owned settings. Eric touched on those rights, but I think it's important that as ombudsman you consider perhaps creating a bill of rights that describes those rights in a way that is consumer-friendly and easy to understand, and that you advocate with your state to require that this bill of rights be given to individuals when they first start receiving services and maybe then also, you know, reviewed at least annually. all the things that you do so well in the nursing home setting. I want to drill down a little bit into a few of the rights that apply to provider-owned or controlled residential settings and talk about advocacy around two specific rights. The first is the right to have a lease or some other legally enforceable agreement that might be a resident admission agreement for the actual unit that the resident owns or rents or occupies. So at the systems level, one thing to consider is advocating for perhaps a uniform state-required agreement to be used, and then work with state officials to create that agreement. I think a state-mandated agreement makes it less likely that a provider may include illegal provisions and really helps to ensure that all residents are guaranteed the same protections and that it's not just luck of the draw on what facility you end up in. The second right I just wanted to touch on also is the right related to eviction, and Eric certainly talked about that. If your state's landlord-tenant laws apply to all your provider-owned or controlled residential settings, then residents have the right to the same protections from eviction as they have under your state's landlord-tenant law. Eric also mentioned that there's kind of a workaround. So for any settings where those laws don't apply, residents have the right to protections that are equal to those given in the landlord-tenant law. So I think this gives residents in assisted living greater rights than many of them have had now, at least in certain states, because we know that some states have very, very few, almost to no transfer discharge rights. So I think this right is extremely important for individuals in these provider controlled or owned settings. So I think there's a major role for ombudsman here to identify, you know, go to your state landlord-tenant laws, identify the eviction protections that are given, be proactive, develop a consumer-friendly, you know, easy-to-understand description, written description of those rights, and then advocate with your state to require facilities to include that description in the lease or resident agreement. I was going to touch on enforcement as my last point, but I think Eric summed that up really well. I think enforcement of these regs is going to be challenging, and that I think the sooner you can start a discussion with your state about their thoughts about how they're going to make sure that facilities and other providers as well actually comply, the sooner you do that, the better. Because we, all of us know from direct experience that these regs are obviously totally useless unless they're enforced. So with that, I'm going to stop. My hope was just to give you a sense of some of the advocacy hotspots, you will, or areas that at some point, and again, sooner rather than later, it will be important for you to, you know, play a role. So thank you.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Robin. So before I open up all of the lines for questions and for dialogue, I'd like to invite Elizabeth Priol with the National Disability Rights Network to share a little bit about some of the resources just released by her organization. Elizabeth, if you'd like to unmute your line, you can hit *7.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can.
Great. Thank you. This is Elizabeth Priol. I work at the National Disability Rights Network, but I'm going to be talking about resources that not just I created, actually, but resources that a partnership of all the three agencies that are funded under the DD Act. We got together. We all have funding from the federal government to provide technical assistance to basically there's three of us. One is the agency that supports training and technical assistance to the protection and advocacy programs. The second is receives federal funding to provide training and technical assistance to the what used to be called university affiliated programs is now called university centers for excellence on disability, and sometimes disability and aging. And then the third is the National Association of Centers for Developmental Disabilities that provide training and technical assistance to the Councils on Developmental Disabilities. So the three agencies got together and decided that, because it was going to be so urgent for people to be able to know when states are putting in their transition plans, as Eric mentioned, states are under incredibly tight time frames, so that if they have a waiver or state plan amendment up for renewal, then they would have to do the 30-day common period, and in addition have to put in an opportunity for public comment for at least 30 days and synthesize that comment prior to finalizing their transition plan for all state services, and they would have to submit that within 120 days. So the point is, states are under really tight time frames, and we wanted to make sure that long-term care ombudsman, disability advocates, and others knew when states were publishing their draft transition plans, and that they knew where to go, in addition to just the CMS guidance, which is very important, but also guidance from disability and aging organizations. And of course, I'm sure it was already highlighted that the National Senior Citizens Law Center has been putting out wonderful resources and webcasts on the HCBS rules. And so what we've done is create a website called hcbsadvocacy.org. I just want to say right now, we're not implying that other agencies aren't, offering excellent technical assistance. We just decided to stick with these three agencies because we all get federal funding, and it just seemed like we could all bill for this easily. So that's how we came up with the idea for our three agencies. Okay, that said, it's hcbsadvocacy.org, and we've divided into three different sections. One is state resources, where you can click on your state and find out if you have waiver renewals coming up between now and March 17th, 2015. And then we even have a 120-day calculator so that you can figure out from the date that your state submitted for the waiver renewal, how long you have until they are required to submit their transition plan for all state services. And under each state, we also have information that the state may have put out in addition to their transition plan, like any studies that they had done on HCBS services they've been providing and the like. So that's one section. The other section is on all of the, it's called Learn About the New Rules, and it's where we put all the information that Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is offering about the rule. And then the third section is on national resources, where we are listing things like National Senior Citizens Law Center's toolkit. I'm forgetting exactly what they call it, but that wonderful resource. Just Like Home, an Advocate's Guide to Consumer Rights in Medicaid HCBS. But we also have some other documents here, some things that have been done by the National Health Law Program. And I think specifically I wanted to talk about two resources that the NDRN, AUCD, and National Association of Developmental Disability Councils have created specifically for this. One is a checklist of how disability and aging advocates might want to begin as far as organizing to impact and ensure the implementation of this rule. And it includes things from basic strategies like educate about the rule to ideas for how you can, for example, like a template of a letter that you might write to your state to explain why or why not a presumed institutional setting is, in fact, HCBS, or on the flip side, why a setting that the state is considering HCBS maybe from your experience might not actually have the qualities of HCBS. So, in other words, letters that would help you submit comments. And so I highly encourage you to go to this study. Oh, the other resource I wanted to point out was what we're calling the HCBS Advocates Worksheet. And what it is it includes the regulatory language from the CMS guidance in an easy-to-use format. And basically, it allows you to go through the actual guidance and determine if the state has existing standards that will help ensure that they are meeting the new rule requirements. And if there is existing guidance, you can list where it might be. If there's not, you can list that that is something that the state needs to create, let's say about provider requirements, rates, whatever it might be. And then I just wanted to mention why I think this is so important. What we have heard from folks that serve support the DD directors is that just like everyone said so far, the state is just hankering for more guidance from CMS on how to interpret some of these requirements and how they can, in a more concrete way, implement the rules. And one example I was given is, how do we ask Ms. Smith to move out of her group home when we know there is limited HCBS options already? And we want to say, sorry, this group home is closing because it doesn't meet the requirements of the new HCBS rules. And yet, if we look at the requirements, it talks about things like ensuring autonomy and dignity and individual choice. Well, it's going to be hard for us to say it doesn't ensure autonomy, dignity, and privacy unless we have something more concrete from CMS as to what those terms mean. And I think that is a legitimate point and something that the Long-Term Care Ombudsman and Aging and Disability Advocates can really help with. We've been dealing with these terms of autonomy, dignity, individual choice for, you know, over a decade. And instead of waiting for CMS to come out with more guidance, we could go to our state and say, look, here are some ways where we can show you what is community and what is not, even amongst your particular state. And so I think I will stop there.
Great. Thanks so much, Elizabeth. So I'm going to unmute everyone's lines now so you can take this opportunity to ask some questions. So once I do that, everyone's lines will be unmuted. If you're not speaking and want to mute your line, you can do so hitting the button on your phone or by pressing star 6.
The conference has been unmuted.
Okay. And I think John McDermott from Hawaii, you might have had a question if you want to start us off.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, great. Well, I was just wondering, as the different states work on their transition plans, is there any way that they can post those on the CMS website so that, you know, we can all learn from one another if our plan is lacking in something, if we overlook something, seeing somebody else's plan can might trigger that. And this way, you know, across the country, everybody's getting same rights, the same access to services. It's just more consistent if we learn from one another.
This is Eric. I don't think CMS intends to do that. Elizabeth was talking about the HCBS advocacy site, and I think that's the intention of that site is to put that information out there. And also, you can look at it now, for example, and there's information on Wyoming and Iowa and Oregon, which I'll say I'll just take 2 seconds to say what I learned from looking at that and make a point. What I've seen there, particularly in Iowa and Wyoming, is that the transition plans that they put out there haven't dealt with substance, that the supposed transition plans they've posted are more about the process to develop a plan, you know, do such and such surveys, have such and such work groups, study this and that, I think they're inappropriate because they don't talk about how the state programs are going to be changed. So other people may have a take on that, but that's my 2 cents on what I've seen already. It's a plug for HCBS advocacy in a sense that the advocates community was probably going to have to do it themselves because I don't think CMS intends to create that level of transparency. Becky may know differently.
Yeah, this is Becky. I do think that CMS has some plans to have more transparency than they have in other programs in the past, but I don't know that I have enough specificity on that to be able to say more about exactly what they're planning. I do think that is a priority, and that's something we are continuing to push to, that there be more transparency of what those plans look like. And also we'd like to see sort of the summary of the public comments that states have to develop. They have to sort of summarize what the comments are, and then we'd like to see that publicly posted too. So we're continuing to work with CMS on seeing if those things can be all available. But I think Elizabeth's comment about this, the website that is being constructed, is it's there now. So some of that information is really very helpful. And so congratulations, Elizabeth, to you and the folks you've been working with on getting that up and going so soon.
Becky, can I ask, do you know if CMS will at least post the public hearing period so that, you know, everybody in my state knows when, where, what they should be reading, reviewing? You know, how do they find this out?
I think that has to come from the state. I don't think that CMS, the public comment period is 30 days from whenever the state says it is. So I don't think CMS is going to be posting that level of process, unless it's included specifically in a transition plan that gets posted. I think that really has to come from your state.
Yeah.
Well, I can comment on that.
Oh, great.
It actually says in the rule some requirements for the public comment plan, and it says that when the state submits its statewide transition plan, they must submit evidence that they posted notice in the state's official organ. But, you know, so I would think that that's the state, you know, DD website or development or Medicaid website, but that's what it says, official organ, and that the posting must include the assessment process that they're planning to use, the detailed plan of how they plan to comply, and the summary of the public's comments to the plan. So they are, and basically it says you have to post the notice in 2 places, and one of them has to be in their official organ. So,
right, but those are still by the state, not by CMS.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, if everybody knew that the one-stop shop, you know, is CMS, that's where you go and you find that information, then you don't have to figure out where is it listed in my state. And also in Hawaii, we do have a lot of residents in assisted living facilities whose children live on the mainland. And so, you know, if it's posted on a bulletin board at the state capitol, they're not going to see that. So it just seems easier to get everybody involved if it was on a CMS website. That's just my opinion.
Thanks, John. Hi, everyone. This is Lori. We're open for questions. All of your lines are unmuted, so I know there won't be a mass asking all at once, but we'll take the next question.
This is Melanie, Georgia. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead, Melanie.
So it seemed like somewhere there was a list of states that were maybe going to be, you know, had to look at it more quickly than others. Am I thinking of something else? So that would at least give us a clue maybe when to be watching for all of that? Or am I thinking about something else?
No, I think you're right, Melanie. Yeah, on one of the calls, Becky had read us a list of states that were up first.
We also have a list of the states that are expected to have waiver renewals or amendments between now and March 17th, 2015, and it's on the hcbs.org website.
Would you say it again where it is?
Well, it's the hcbsadvocacy.org website, rather. Sorry. And it's actually, it says key dates and deadlines, and it lists states with waivers expiring actually June 30th, 2014. So those are really ones where you've got to get on the stick.
Thanks.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Next question.
So this is Jackie in Vermont.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I assume that these rules don't apply to states that provide their home and community-based services through 1115 waivers, and I was just wondering if there was any thought or if anyone knew what CMS was planning on doing about those states and expanding these regulations to those states.
So this is Becky. Hi, Jackie. I have looked at the CMS website on their Medicaid.gov/HCBS website, and if you go on the questions and answers section, question number 4 is how will the final rule affect existing HCBS offered by states under 1915C waivers, state plan programs like 1915I and 1915K, and 1115 demonstrations? And their answer is rather long, so I won't read all of it to everybody, but the last sentence of that response says, CMS will include requirements in the special terms and conditions of 1115 demonstrations that impact individuals receiving HCBS services. So you may want to take a look at that full answer, but it looks like CMS is signaling that they're going to be using 1115 terms and conditions as a vehicle.
Do you think that's when the states are renewing those waivers or do you think they're applying them to existing?
Yeah, in terms of the process. That's a really good question, and this answer doesn't clarify that point. So what I would suggest is you might want to take this Q&A and cut and paste it and send it to that hcbs@cms.hhs.gov email address and say, we have an 1115. I see your response here. What does that mean in terms of process? Unless Eric or Elizabeth have heard something in addition to that, that's where I would go with that question.
Thank you.
This is Eric. I haven't heard anything. I would say that this is one of those areas where you may want to ask for something. I think both with the 1115s and also with the Community First Choice, I had this discussion with some folks in Oregon, that for those programs, they're not explicitly included in the transition rules. So the state, if you just by the exact letter of the regulations, the transition plan doesn't have to include the existing Community First Choice option or existing 1115. But if you just think about it practically, how much that doesn't make any sense. You shouldn't just ignore it. And so it makes a lot of sense to ask the state or to demand the state whatever you can do to deal with it, depending on this, because just based on the facts of the particular state, it may make tremendous amount of sense to address 1115 now when you may be dealing with some other areas of HCBS, or it doesn't make sense to wait if the waiver isn't coming up for renewal for 4 years, to just sit there for 4 years and not deal with it. So I'm not sure what's, like Becky said, I think it's unclear from the CMS guidance, but it's not like CMS has anticipated every problem that's going to come up. Here's another screwy thing, and I think that it would probably benefit from some advocacy to make sure that the 1115s and the community first choice doesn't fall through the cracks.
Thanks, everyone. Next question. So while you're all thinking of the next question, have any of you in your states started having conversations or communicating with your Medicaid agency or any other agency in the state around this process?
Hi, this is Carla in Ohio. I'm on for Bev today.
Hi, Carla.
And we were recently invited to a meeting with our Department of Medicaid and Aging to start the stakeholder process. It's happening in July.
And that stakeholder process, Carla, will that be broader groups that are coming together to talk about this?
Yes. Yeah, it won't just be the Ombudsman Program. But we had the ability to invite some regional staff as well. So we were encouraged by the number of attendees they allowed us to have a select, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Great. Any other states getting involved already?
Hey, Lori.
Any other programs?
Alice in Maryland.
Hi, Alice.
And our state Medicaid offices convened a stakeholders group last week, and they invited the Department of Aging, and then I sort of invited myself and have asked to participate in the other groups, but apparently they plan to meet on a regular basis.
Great. Thanks, Alice, and I love it that you invited yourself to that meeting.
I said that we had been highly encouraged at the federal level to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Lori, can I jump in for a quick comment?
Please,
so,
John.
So NASHUED, have they been told, if you're sitting at the table with Medicaid, please also include your ombudsman? Alice shouldn't have had to invite herself. And my boss maybe is meeting with Medicaid folks, and I don't even know about it, and I haven't been invited. So can NASHUED do something about that?
John, we can certainly reach out and have that conversation with them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I want to just be really clear that my boss told me about it. I just wasn't on the list from Medicaid, so I asked them to invite me. But I'll put a bug in her ear, too, because she's the president of NASHUED now.
Thanks, Alice.
This is Elizabeth.
Yes, please, Elizabeth, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I think that's one of the weaknesses of the rule. It says, you know, public comment for 30 days that the state has to then summarize and incorporate and explain why it's incorporating it in its statewide transition plan, but there's no actual guidance which says that they should include stakeholder input beyond that 30 days. And I mean, CMS has said that they want people to continue to send in comments throughout the process. They can send it directly to CMS federal offices, you know, even beyond that 30-day period. But I think it's really disappointing that they didn't actually say, and in the development of the plans, particular stakeholders need to be included. I just want to mention, I know that D.C. has already had some stakeholder meetings about its transition plan, and I know that the PNAs are involved, and Wyoming has already developed a list of who's going to be in its transition plan committee. But there is a requirement of a committee, is what I meant to say.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions, comments? Okay. Well, this is not going to be the last conversation we have about this rule, but we wanted to start the conversation, start putting out before you all different advocacy strategies and ways to get involved. We're delighted that Eric and Becky and Robin and Elizabeth were able to join us today, and thank you all for the information that you've shared and the presentations and the resources that you've shared. They're all very valuable. With Elizabeth being invited to participate today, that we'd like to encourage you to do some outreach to your protection and advocacy associations in your state, because that's who Elizabeth's organization represents. And as you can see from the work that they've been doing, they're also very actively involved in this process. And so it might be an opportunity for either developing new collaborations or re-energizing collaborations that may have gone stale, or just continuing those that, you know, you've been working on, but they would be good partners in this process. If you do have additional questions, please send them to us. As was mentioned earlier, this call has been recorded. We'll post it to the login side of the Resource Center website, and we'll also send around notes from the call along with the resources that have been listed out today and the slides that Eric shared with us. So thanks to Eric, Robin, Becky, and Elizabeth for joining us today. Thanks to Aaliyah for managing the call. And with that, we'll close out for today, and we'll be in touch soon. So have a good rest of the afternoon.